Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Shalom. I'm well. Yourself?
I'm doing well.
He changed what he said.
I feel like saying Bokertobe
we,
now.
We definitely didn't record this already and have to restart. And
definitely
Tim
not.
Definitely didn't change the Hebrew word he said.
Bokertobe.
Bokertobe lecha.
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Charlie?
It's cold. It's cold out there.
Oh, man. I love this weather. Mm-hmm. I drove today. It was like 6:50 on my way here. And there was a beautiful sunrise.
Yes.
And I've never experienced that because I always lived like 1 minute.
This feels like a very beautiful fall we've had so far.
Shana Tova. Rosh Hashanah happened.
What
like
did you just say to me?
A week and a half ago, and we had Yom Kippur was just around the corner.
Very nice.
And when this airs, it was like 3 days ago. So this is the time of the Jewish holidays. Shana Tova means good year, so it's like a happy new year.
Oh.
As you celebrate fall, fall is like the season.
Season. Yeah. Oh, that's fun. That's really cool. I love fall. It's my favorite season.
The Jewish guy was blowing the shofar last night at an event that we were at.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. I did see the pictures of that you posted.
So,
or your wife posted, maybe.
We weren't blowing any shofars, but last night after the kids went to bed, we were sitting there in the living room and working, and Melissa turned on instrumental Christmas music, and I was like... And we're going to be putting our winter decorations up
that's
soon.
Not,
I'm so excited.
No.
So I have changed on this one, Charlie. I'm not like a 6 month Christmas guy, but I like the winter season. So I don't mind that it's already started.
I'm tempted to put out Christmas lights in October just because to offset the Halloween lights.
Because also Reformation Day.
I can get on that. I can get on board with
that. But Reformation Day is the end of the month, and that's where Halloween is. And so I do like the idea of, let's just get going on all the Christian holidays and forget this nonsense. And Thanksgiving is a perfect thankfulness in the midst of all that. So anyways, I don't know. I'm changing my old age, Charlie. I'm getting old. I was always against this stuff. And now I'm like, but it's such a short.
Give me 10 years. We'll
see.
That's fine. Okay. All right. So this morning we're drinking the coffee trade from Avon, Connecticut from Pastor Carper.
Oh yeah.
Thank you, Pastor Carper.
And
Jackson, his son. Goes
it's a
to
full
my
city Sumatra roast. And so that's like a medium dark. And I would say it's got some punch. It's not bad.
I opted for the dark roast today, I didn't hate it.
Yep. Yeah. we're more light roast fans on this podcast. Yeah. But it wasn't a bad dark roast.
All right.
My second cup is Tim's light roast. What is this, Tim?
It's Ethiopian.
See, Ethiopian, man, right there. Mm.
Good stuff. And... one quick announcement. If you have not left us a 5-star review on Apple, I believe we're still trying to get to 200. I haven't looked to see how many there are, but we're into the teens, I believe. And so please do that 5-star review. When we get to 200, we're going to give away free stuff. So you should sign up to get free stuff. And I think with that, we're ready to do the thing that we always do.
So before we do that, keep writing in. Like my last 2 months, August and September are just like psycho for me, but I'm really bad. I actually logged into the Thinklings email and saw several people have written in and stuff. So keep writing into us.
And I'm
going to start going through those
we
too.
We will at some point have another talk episode where we...
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking that the other day. We haven't done a talk in a while.
That
would be really good.
August and September are just so bad. Yeah. Like from until I teach my module at the end of September, it's like psycho. So anyway, keep writing in. I just wanted to throw that out there.
We love you all.
There are some good questions in there too.
We will have a little bit of listener feedback in this episode during my content.
Okay.
Because I got some really intriguing feedback about my last episode.
So with that, books and business.
Let's talk about some books.
I think I'll go first. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading a little, but it's more listening in the car is the only kind of reading I'm doing. But I did post a new article and it's called Screwtape's Favorite Song. And it's an homage to C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters. And so in it, and I think I did a good job. I was hoping this would go a little wider, but if you haven't read it yet, listener, I've got some really good feedback on this. It's a discussion between the older demon Screwtape and the younger demon Wormwood. And Wormwood is trying to tempt people. And so he's considering using pornography. And so it starts off with Screwtape saying pornea is a great way to go, but sometimes it trips up the ally within your human. Oh, you don't know about the ally. And so the ally is the conscience. And so the whole discussion is, can you find a temptation that doesn't alarm the conscience as immediately and as strongly as pornography? And Screwtape encourages Wormwood to shift into the realm of music. And so he talks about music is good because you're just listening to it. You're not really thinking about the words. And then it's as though Wormwood says, well, what's your favorite song? And Screwtape says, well, the last 50 years have been a smorgasbord of seduction, but if I had to go with someone, I'd pick Taylor Swift. And so then I talk about three or four Taylor Swift songs, and I kind of point out how from the beginning her songs have been wicked, but there's kind of been this like general appeal for a while. Now she's out and out. Like her most recent one is horrible. Like the wordings are just totally wicked, but that's always been there. So it was a really interesting article. If you have not read it, I would recommend it. And if you find it, anytime we write something, if you find it beneficial and you feel like you can, I would ask you to share it on social media. Facebook sort of knows when you post an article, and if they can get money to have us boost it, they sort of, I think they a little bit make it harder. So I would say if you listen to it, you're blessed by it and you want to share it, that'd be great. I have gotten more personal messages about this article than anything I posted.
Really?
And they've all been positive.
Oh.
But I think the spicy nature of it, I think people are less
inclined.
Yeah, it's probably not the most popular topic. So anyways, that's my books and business.
I mentioned this book a few weeks back. I'm almost done with it, and we will come back to it. I think it deserves some full airtime. This is The Christian Mind by Harry, and I don't know if it's pronounced right, but I say Blumiris. I don't know if that's right. Essentially, social commentary by a Christian intellectual of and in Great Britain in the 60s. And he's talking about the way that Christians think and illustrating in his own culture how secularism has dominated within the ways Christians and the church thinks about matters. And it's been very, very intriguing and a good read. It's a very good read. And the chapter I was just in most recently, he was talking about how there's this humanist idea of progress and how we always make progression. We make progression. And then he kind of put that idea of the early 1900s of human ideal and progression next then to like this church growth idea that there's something wrong with the church and we need to fix it. It needs to be more relevant. And how almost wholly people, Christians accept that those premises. Like we talk about the church in a very secular way that it needs to progress and we expect the church is going to get better and we're going to finally get there. And he's like, no, like, and in the wake of World War II, he's like, you know, if we drop H bombs on the world and everything is destroyed, guess what will still be there? The Bible tells us the church will still be there. And it's not the church needs to be more relevant. It's dying. It's not a church needs to progress to meet our modern cultures, you know, whatever. He's like, the church is the thing.
Amen.
And the culture needs to come to the church and make changes. That's not right. The other way around.
That's right.
And it's a very good read of that chapter. And I don't understand the references, maybe the social cues that he's talking in his context. So I probably need to read it again a couple of times, but this is a very good book. It's a very good book. And, so The Christian Mind, Harry Blumiris, it's not an easy read, but if you purchase it, it's worth your time and we'll rank it in another episode.
You've totally intrigued me, by the way. All your, like, this has got to be on my to read list in the future.
And where I heard about it, Alistair McGrath referenced it in his book, Mere Discipleship. And this guy would have been a contemporary known Lewis. I don't know how much they knew each other, but definitely alluded to the fact that they have conversed. And so it just seems like another mind in that zone. Helpful, a good thinking book to maybe peel back the layers of how we commonly think and to dissect, am I thinking how a Christian should think. And so, yeah, good book.
Last week, I mentioned Rescue Plan and Rescue Skills by Deepak Raju and Jonathan Holmes. So I've now read Rescue Plan, Charting a Course to Restore Prisoners of Pornography. Interesting that your content is about, or your books and business was about your article and pornography. Mm-hmm. So
that was, part of it.
Part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Immorality and in its more incipient forms. So with this, you know, this is a topic that is not going to go away. And this book's been on my to-read list for quite a while. I really do like Finally Free by Heath Lambert. I still really like that book. And I'm probably still going to continue using that book. But this book was still very helpful. The book is divided into basically three sections, which, by the way, I don't know if this is a, I might read sections of this book with somebody, but Finally Free, I can read it with somebody I'm counseling. And I've done that on multiple occasions. This book is really geared more towards the counselor. So what is the real goal of trying to help somebody who's enslaved to pornography? The goal is not just to get them to quit looking at pornography, it's to change their heart. So, what is that? What's the plan? What's the goal? That's what this book's about. The plan is we need to change the heart as opposed to changing behavior. So you've heard us talk about this on multiple occasions on the podcast, and this book supports that same premise, that same idea. So I really did like the book. I thought it was very good. He uses the analogy of a battle, a rescue operation in World War II, where they had to get the plan. They had to see the layout of the enemy's base, and then they had to execute the plan to rescue the POWs from the camp. So he divides the book into three sections based upon that real story from World War II. You need to know your enemy, and then you need to know the lay of the land, okay, like what's going on out there, and then you need to rescue the prisoner. And that's like the execution part. And a lot of people are going to skip probably to the rescue the prisoner part because they are going to think, well, that's the part that's really relevant to me. And I would encourage you to not do that. Basically, knowing your enemy, you know, sin is the real issue here. And sin makes a mess of everything, including intimacy. So he has a whole chapter on addictions, and he's basically quoting Ed Welch, his Addictions, A Banquet in the Grave, and talking about how addictions are a major issue, and it's a one, it's what pornography is. It's an addiction. And then the addict's four foes, and the four foes are, he's basically riffing off of Heath Lambert. The four foes are access, anonymity, appetite, and atheism. So Lambert had three of those: access, anonymity, and appetite. He added atheism, which isn't something that Lambert's going to disagree with. In fact, it was kind of a theme in Lambert's book too. If you don't believe, if you're not an atheist, if you believe God does exist and you really truly fear him, then you won't want to indulge in pornography and masturbation.
Okay.
Right. So the access thing is cutting off the access. You know, that's a pretty common theme we've talked about. Anonymity. Okay. You need to be in a place where there's nobody around. You need to be able to indulge and have that anonymity. And an appetite. Okay. You need to curb your appetite. It's the desire that's the issue. That's the real issue. And then connecting that to atheism. So the addict's four foes. Those are the four things that are part of the lay of the land. Knowing your enemy. Then the next section is know the lay of the land. And this was a unique part of the book that I say is probably the most helpful. He deals with masturbation specifically in two chapters, chapters 4 and 5. In the first chapter 4, masturbation is not what God wants. Okay, so because and I have recognized this and spoken about this as well, there are several Christian authors who don't take a strong stand against masturbation, and he does, and he makes an entire chapter where he argues against it.
That is really good. So in Tim Challies's book, Sexual Detox, he says, is it possible that like a thoughtless thing could, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But then he's like, I don't see any way that can happen. He makes a very strong argument that there's really no possible way for it to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's okay, but there's a little bit of a cracked open door there for some people. And then Doug Wilson, he unfortunately has this thing, like if you're a married guy and you're traveling and something happens and you kind of had to take care of it, don't worry about it and just move on with your life or whatever. But it's almost like you're thinking lawful thoughts about your own wife, so that's okay. Mm-hmm. So it's like in marriage, you know, it makes a little space for it. Mm-hmm. And then when I was way back in my evangelical days, there's a very well-known youth pastor guru who's like, this is not a big deal. You should tell kids to do this to keep them from porn.
Right.
And that's horrible advice, absolutely horrible. So I'm really, that's a good thing to hear, because I think it's funny, but we need direct statements that that's wrong.
Right.
And it's funny that they're opposite out there. I was shocked to find this out.
Yeah.
And just on that note too, you know, sometimes people's actions reveal more about how you should think about an issue. There's a reason why people hide it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's because their flesh naturally knows that this is wrong. Mm. And I had a youth sponsor in high school that told me, shout out Tim, you usually don't hide things that you know are right.
That's right.
And so why am I hiding that? And so like this, the idea of like, oh, maybe it's okay. Maybe, well, they're still not talking about it. And there's a reason they're still not talking about it.
Yeah.
It's because they naturally know, like, man, this is not right.
And man, parents, any parents listening with little kids, hey, sorry, we didn't see this coming. So sorry, we probably should have put a disclaimer at this point on the episode, but
yeah,
mature themes.
Thanks, Tim.
So James Dobson, he is one that has spoken that it is not, it shouldn't be it's not something you should speak against. Okay. So that's James Dobson. So he basically takes a case against him. I thought interesting too, his arguments against were not my typical arguments against. His were a little bit just more nonspecific. I go to Deuteronomy. I think the case is pretty strong from Deuteronomy, but I recognize most people don't like Deuteronomy or aren't familiar with it. Anyway, and then he even quotes C.S. Lewis, and that Lewis even spoke on this, which was news to me. Yeah. So anyway, so there's, it's in the letters section. He wrote a letter to somebody once and he spoke on it. So then he has 10 strategies to address masturbation specifically. And so there's really helpful information. In fact, I have most of my little bullets and dog ears from that section. One of the other aspects of the book, and especially the rescue the prisoner section.
Tim, you can keep talking. There's just, Doug Brown wants some coffee. You guys, so he's coming in to get some coffee.
That's light.
The rescue the prisoner section, he addresses singleness, dating, marriage, and then children and teenagers. So obviously that's going to be the more counseling type of section that people are going to want to go to. And it is helpful there. There's some very helpful information there. I don't know how much was really revolutionary, but it was still helpful information from a counseling perspective. Good to see you.
It's like Santa Doug, remember? Like Santa Doug would show up. Sorry, Tim. He needed coffee, though. That was a legit reason to come in and interrupt us.
Last chapter I'm going to talk about is chapter 6, the similarities and differences between men and women. And this is another thing that is quite unique about the book, is that he talks about women and the struggle with porn and masturbation.
Oh, that's really good.
With women.
Yeah.
And so I talked to my wife specifically, and I said, I really want you to read this book, because they're saying this is going to be a tsunami type of an issue. Because of Gen X and Gen Alpha, and they have access to phones, and it's become accepted even among women. So fantasy is a massive issue. In fact, one pastor said in our book, we didn't address fantasy enough in Song of Songs for Singles, which I understand that criticism, and perhaps we should have. But this is something that they talk about it a lot. And so I would say that this is a nice supplement there. One criticism would be just in the chapter on marriage. I think that could have been developed more. And if you read our book, I think it does develop how to handle in marriage a little bit better. So I put this as a 7 on the Thinkling's Goodness Scale. I think it's a really good book. And especially if you're counseling young people who are struggling with pornography and masturbation, you should read this I remember a pastor saying one time, I read a book on preaching every once in a while just to stay fresh and to hone my skill. And that was one of the reasons why I picked up this book. I'm counseling people and trying to encourage young men to live lives of purity and holiness. So why not read a book that's going to help keep you fresh on counseling methods and things that you can say to be better used by the Lord. I'm going to talk about that a little bit at the end in the Devo section too. So,
you said the quote, he quoted Tripp, and it was, "Addictions are a banquet in the grave."
Addictions, a banquet in the grave.
Ed Welch.
It's the name of a book.
Ed Welch. I'm sorry, not Tripp.
Yep,
Ed Welch.
No problem.
Yeah.
It is the name of a book.
Addictions, banquet.
It's a textbook at Faith for some class.
I've never heard that one.
Yeah, it's really good. Dr. Newman used it in one of his counseling classes. I think kept carried on. I'm not sure if Wilkening is. I assume he was.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So. I think he is.
Reminded me of Numbers, where there's literally a location called the Graves of Craving. But anyway,
Let's have a conversation about Jesus calling the Presbyterians. Yes, this is part two of our ecclesiological odyssey, where we are talking about different denominations and what happened at their summer meetings and other things relating to denominations. So this week, we want to talk about the Presbyterians, specifically the conservative Presbyterians and the PCA denominations. And part of what we need to talk about is the distinction between the Presbyterians, who are conservative, and the Presbyterians, who are liberals. But the real issue that we want to get to is a vote that they had this summer to do a sort of an investigation into a book that was written by one of their missionaries. So that's where we're going. But the first thing I want to do is I want to follow up with some feedback from my last episode. So the last time we got together, we were talking about the United Methodists and they're wanting to be gay. And so then, or they wanted gay pastors. And so then they voted to break the denomination into regions and all that. So friend of all of us on the podcast here, Pastor Ben Hartwig out in Green, Iowa, he gave me a voice message on the phone and we were going back and forth with these. And he said, I just want to give you a little bit of on the ground experience of this exact issue. So in Green, Iowa, there's a Presbyterian church, and it's one of the there's a Methodist church, it's one of the United Methodist liberal denominations. And he said, I would agree with your observation, that I'd made an observation in the video that it seemed like a lot of women. And remember, this denominational meeting is the pastors. And so it seemed like a lot of women pastors and a lot of middle-aged women pastors, just observation, and a lot of American. But then the foreigners, they were all mostly male. And he said, his observation has been that same thing in this Methodist church. That's what they've had. And they currently have a middle-aged woman pastor, so-called. And he says, but generally it's either that or someone overseas who's coming here to pastor as a woman. And he said, what's really interesting about their local church, their local United Methodist church, is that they have joined with a liberal brethren church. But what they have is they call it a yoke parish. So like a yoke that holds two oxen together. They call this a yoke parish. And so it's been going on for years. And what they do is they swap meetings in each of their buildings. So it's this one United Methodist lady pastor. And then the two congregations meet either at their building or the other building. And they just go back and forth. And they've been doing this. And recently, they've added a local liberal Presbyterian denomination. So not the ones we're going to talk about today. And so what they do is 4 months of the year, the Methodist lady will be in one of the buildings, and then they'll switch to the other building and switch to the other building and go back to the first building. And so they just trade buildings, and then they pool their money and they only have to pay for one pastor and then upkeep their buildings.
Yeah, so why not just have one building?
So he didn't answer that question. We didn't bring that up, but okay. I have a thought. Why do you go to church if you don't believe the Bible?
Well, it's like a social thing.
Social, it's maybe tradition, it's like history. Uh-huh. And so do you want to get rid of that traditional old building with all the memories? Oh, gotcha. We got to keep it alive. I don't know.
It's like a standard in the community.
Maybe, yeah.
Community building.
I'm not really sure if that's it. It could be.
Okay.
So, but he said if you combined all the people from the three congregations, he thinks there's maybe north of maybe 30 people total. So I think what's happening is, as a function of their unbelief, they have shrunk, and there's so few of them that they can't any individual group afford to pay a pastor. So when they all pull together, they can afford to pay a so-called pastor. And he said, he's like, I'm just thinking, like, how a Presbyterian, if they really believe Presbyterian theology, could get along with a Methodist, if they really believe Methodist theology, is just beyond me. And I think that's just an indictment that they don't actually believe those things anymore. So I thought that was interesting. So thanks for the listener feedback, Ben. We appreciate it. And also thanks for the coffee infused honey from your relatives out in New York that it got dropped off to me yesterday in class. I'm excited to see what coffee infused honey tastes like. Okay, let's talk about the summer meetings of the Presbyterian Church in America. So we talked about the Methodist Church Council or gathering. So this summer was the 51st Annual General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in America. Now, their acronym is PCA. Now, this is where, listener, you've got to be precise, because there's another denomination of Presbyterians called the Presbyterian Church USA, and they go by PCUSA. The PCUSA is totally liberal. They're doing all the liberal stuff. But the PCA is conservative. And so there's an online YouTuber named Matthew Everhard. I've watched his videos for years. He does, he has the Eagle, like you and I, the Eagle Bible, Tim.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of online reviews, like a 2-year crash test, a 3-year crash test, a 5-year crash test, where he's like, look at how it's holding up, look at all the notes. He started reviewing a lot of different Bibles for Crossway. He's put out some really interesting stuff. I've read a couple of his books. But he switched from an evangelical Presbyterian church, I think down in Florida, to now he is in the PCA denomination. And so they're a conservative denomination. And when he actually made that shift, I only remembered the PCUSA from my church history days. And I thought, oh man, is he going liberal? But no, he's conservative. So let me just tell you a couple of notable people who come out of the PCA denomination. So you got like a flavor of this denomination. So Tim Keller, he's the most well-known. He's a PCA guy. And so Tim Keller was one of the founders of the Gospel Coalition, Together for the Gospel. I know he has issues. I know he's got some problems, and I totally agree with those problems, but he does have some good books that have been helpful, and he has some good things he's done. So I do think I wouldn't totally throw him out. The Surgeon General from 1982 to 1989, C. Everett Koop, he was a PCA guy. And I remember hearing this, like there was some sort of Christianity about him. But for me, the way I remember his name is every time my grandpa would pull out a new pack of Marlboro cigarettes and I would read the Surgeon General's warning, it was like C. Everett Koop was like the sign Surgeon General on all those warnings. So he was the guy, and he's a PCA guy. D. James Kennedy, he's PCA. I mean, super well-known PCA. Stephen Curtis Chapman, SCC, baby.
Oh, boy.
I know. Like, I don't know. That's a shout out to, there's one listener who is like an old time SCC fan. So shout out to you, but I'm not supporting him either. Susan Wise Bauer. Tim?
No,
the History of the World. She's the one who wrote The History of the World. The Well-Trained Mind is her website. Okay. She's big in classical conversations.
Okay.
She's not in classical conversations. She's big in the network. Mm-hmm. There's a certain Kev Dog out there. Reverend Kevin DeYoung. He's a PCA. And then R.C. Sproul. Now, when I read that, I thought he was independent. So I think maybe at one point he was PCA, but then he went independent. But he fellowshipped the PCA. He just wanted autonomy of his local church, which isn't that ironic? RC. Interesting. And so what I wanted to point out here is that this is the conservative, like, I'm not going to agree with their hermeneutics. I'm not going to agree with all their eschatology. I'm going to have some problems with various aspects of theology, but these are people who believe the gospel, as long as they're not relying on their baby sprinkling. And I do think they would take the Bible seriously. They would believe the Bible's inerrant, authoritative, the word of God, those sorts of things. And their church government it operates as local presbyteries. So a presbytery is made up of a bunch of elders, and those elders are like ruling elders. So if I'm understanding this correctly, they kind of look back at Acts 15, and when the Jerusalem Council gets called, they sort of see it as a bunch of the pastors having some sort of authority. And then they take that model and say, that's how we run our churches. You could contrast that with congregational rule, which is what we all operate on, where a local congregation is autonomous. And because the Spirit of God indwells us, we make decisions. And then the other way you could contrast it is the hierarchical system known as the episcopal system. And that would be where you have bishops leading and there's rankings. And that would be the Catholics, the Anglicans, Methodists have some, or Lutherans have that kind of a similar thing going on. It's not exactly the same. And so they're kind of in a different niche there. So they had their summer meeting. And at the summer meeting, there's probably other things that were of note, but I didn't really key in on those. The thing that caught my attention was that Overture 33 that they voted on was that they wanted to do a study. They wanted to form a committee and have the committee do research and a study on a book. And next summer at the 52nd Annual General Conference, they wanted the committee to give their report. So this committee has 1 year to do a report on a book. And that book is none other than Jesus Calling by Sarah Young. Now, Jesus Calling, I have a copy on my desk. I keep it on my desk all the time. And on it, I have put a label that says coaster. And if you look at it, there are coffee stains all over this little book.
So it is on the shack stack.
It's so on the shack stack, I use it as a coffee coaster. And I purposely spilled coffee on it. Because when students come, I hand them that, and then I have a copy of Heaven is for Real by Todd Burpo. And I have a clearly labeled coaster right on the spine, piece of paper taped to it that says coaster. And it's sort of a teaching thing. I have an Osteen book I haven't put coaster on yet. But I do this because I want people to see that this is not a good book and you shouldn't use it. I have a good friend of mine who, because of their kind of interaction in the culture and sort of a ministry context with kind of broader evangelicalism, they would often get gifts, and every time they got Jesus Calling as a gift, they would not return it to get more money. And this person is very cheap and very, very good with money. They would throw it away. They probably threw away 10 or 20 copies in their lifetime. That's a lot of money they could have got, but they're like, it's trash. I'm not going to put that back. I'm just going to throw it away. It would be better to throw it away. Now, listener, maybe you've never heard of this book before. And that's probably good for you to know about this. And that's actually part of the motivation of the Presbyterians at this meeting to do something, because this book is still very popular. Or two, maybe you have heard of it and you think, I really like this book. Well, I would like to help you with some thoughts that I've been able to pull off the web that might help you to think a little bit differently about the book. And hopefully you would see that biblically, you shouldn't use this book. And the reasons are quite serious. Okay, so let's go ahead and I want to annotate through two articles. And so you can find these on the web if you'd like. The first one is on a blog called Reformation 21, and it's by Todd Pruitt, and it's called Jesus Calling and the PCA. And essentially it's just a report about the conference this summer, but I want to read a couple of highlights. This conference had 2,160 commissioners. I think that's kind of like a messenger from a church, and it was the third highest attended assembly in the PCA history. I'm not sure if it's because of this or if that's just part of it. And so if you read that statement of Overture 33, what are the instructions they voted on? Here are the instructions. Number one, they want to examine the history of, there's something called the Committee on Discipleship Ministries within the PCA. And so they want to examine the history of the CDM, that group, and the relationship of that group with this book. And they want to outline the reasons for withdrawing the book from its inventory previously and not offering it for sale since. So there's a ministry within this group called the Committee on Discipleship Ministries. They used to sell Jesus Calling, but then they pulled it and they've no longer offered it. And they want to know why is that. Secondly, they want to assess the book's appropriateness for Christians in general and for PCA members and congregations in particular, with special regard to two of its features, its doctrine and its method. Now notice, we often say like, well, there's nothing in that doctrinal statement I disagree with, but method matters. And that's part of what they want to look into, not just the doctrine, but the method. And then number three, provide recommendations if needed for remedial materials, advisory statements, or general assembly actions concerning the book Jesus Calling. I would just say if they need remedial materials, they just need to wait for a discipleship book that's going to be coming out here pretty soon. Then I think it'll be a really good one.
Nice.
Thank you. I knew Tim would like that. All right. So Todd Pruitt, who's writing this article, said, he said, I understand the confusion and the objections. Indeed, the PCA's General Assembly convened. When it convened, I was on the fence. I wasn't sure how I'd vote on this overture. A week prior to the assembly, I told another teaching elder that I was likely to vote against it as I consider the whole thing a waste of time. So Todd Pruitt is like, why are we even worrying about this heretical book? We don't need to mess with it. Then he says this, but three factors work to change my mind and vote in favor of this overture. The first factor, and so he's going to give three reasons that he decided I am going to vote that we should review this book and make a public statement. The first reason is that Steve and Sarah Young's longtime service as a PCA missionary. So here's the thing. Sarah Young has been a PCA missionary to Japan for a long time. Like the whole life. And so here it's this woman writes this book and it's kind of heretical. And then if you think about it, they look into it and they're like, wait, she's one of our missionaries in Japan. So that, because of it, is important. He said he had known for some time that Mrs. Young and her husband were PCA missionaries, and that had been a source of dismay for me, considering the profoundly errant foundation of the book, which undermines the sufficiency of Scripture. Many PCA members were surprised to learn that she was a missionary with the PCA because her articles started appearing in Christianity Today and other places, and they realized, whoa, she's PCA? So because of that reason, the misunderstanding or the unknownness of her PCA statement, they're like, we really should make a statement about this. Otherwise, maybe people think we like it. Number two, the second reason is the division and the damage that's been done by this book. He had not thought about Jesus calling for quite some time. So this is a long time ago. Tim Challies writes his first review, I believe, in 2004. That's how old this book is. But he just tells how he witnessed these errors firsthand. And he says, quote, for many, it had become a kind of second Bible. So this book became secondary to the Bible, almost like a second Bible that some people read. And he says, and why not? The author purported to have recorded the words of Jesus that she had been receiving during times of her meditation. So the premise of this book is that Sarah Young sits in a meditative state and listens. And then when she gets messages, those are from Jesus and she writes them down. Then she publishes them. And they're very ooey-gooey. We'll have some examples here in a moment. And so he thought that's horrible. And then number three, this is really interesting. He says, I want to explain the third reason why I changed my mind to vote in favor of Overture 33 very carefully. I wish to communicate no disrespect to Steve Young, Sarah's loving husband. To the surprise of most, if not everyone in the General Assembly, Steve Young, who is also a PCA teaching elder, spoke from the floor during the debate this summer. He spoke in opposition to the overture, and he offered strong support for both his wife and the book, Jesus Calling. And he says, I'm not begrudging him to defend his wife. I would have expected it. But Mr. Young's speech was in opposition to the overture. That was the final impetus for him to say that he wants to vote in favor. And the main reason he changed his mind is because when Steve Young spoke, it was the speech itself that made him think, I've got to vote against this. Steve Young extolled what he thought were the virtues of Jesus Calling, and he repeatedly called attention to the worldwide impact of the book. Now, to me, if you get up and you say, I can't believe we're voting on this, look at how much it's been used by the Lord. Look how it's gone everywhere. Look at the big impact. To me, that's like a bandwagon argument or a pragmatic argument. That's not theological at all. And often when you say truth, it doesn't go everywhere because no one wants it. So I thought this is a really helpful article because it's a guy in the PCA who didn't think this is that big of a deal and thought it was dumb. But then he realized we've got to say something about this. So anyways, some people have claimed it's a hit job. Like a PCA hit job to disparage Sarah Young's testimony. He's like, no. This is like an issue about truth and about discipling people. So, listener, I want to plant a seed. Notice a denomination that takes God's word seriously. A lady's died. Her book is really popular. But then what are they doing? They're being very, very careful to guard truth. Compare that to the last time we talked about the ecclesiological group, the United Methodists. It's a totally different flavor. So then let's go ahead and talk about this. Probably some of you are now thinking, well, what in the world is this book about? Okay, so we're going to go through, go ahead. Tim Challies has an article. Okay, Tim Challies.
Friend of the podcast.
There we go. He has a book, or he has an article from November 11th of 2015 called 10 Serious Problems with Jesus Calling. Now, he's actually got multiple reviews about this book. His first review was from 2004, and it was really interesting. He was kind of tentative, or maybe it was 2011. I think it was 2004. No, it was 2004 because it was a year after he started blogging. He was sort of tentative and cautious and like, this is just not good. But in this one, more people have talked about it, and he's marshaling lots of evidence. So if you're looking for one article that will be a paper trail to a lot of critiques, look up 10 Serious Problems with Jesus Calling by Tim Challies. It's a great resource.
So when Jesus Calling first came out, and this would have been Challies' first review back in 04, it really was a nothing. Like nobody really, it didn't sell, it didn't do a whole lot. I want to say it even went out of print. And then it came back into print, and then it blew up.
Interesting.
So when you think through Challies writing a review in 04, think this is a really minor thing. Nobody's really paying attention to it anyway. It's insignificant. When he's writing in 2015, it's everywhere.
Okay.
And everybody's reading it. So there's a little different flavor to his argumentation there, probably because of those two events.
Man, listeners, isn't it great to have a guy who runs a Christian bookstore for the last 25 years at the table? Man, that is nice. Okay, so we're not going to go through every one of these points, but I think I'll probably hit almost every one of them. So what I want to walk through is, and the reason Challies' article here is so helpful is he has a lot of quotes, and he has very good biblical analysis. So number one reason this is a problem is that in the book, Sarah Young claims to speak for God. Someone who speaks as God's mouthpiece. Is there like a biblical category for that? What do we call that, Charlie?
Like a prophet?
Oh, a prophet. Oh, the OT guy beat you to it. Shocker. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
So I would just say that if you claim to speak for God, you're sort of sitting in the same space as the Old Testament prophet.
So just so our listeners know too, if they pick up a current edition of Jesus Calling, it does not say that she speaks for God. So they modified it, I don't remember when, but they basically, it's in the preface, they talked about how she talks about how she's speaking for God and so on and so forth. So if you get an older copy of the book, in the preface you'll find this. But if you look at the newer copies, it does not say that. They like scrubbed it and took out a lot of the charismatic stuff, I think in response to the pushback that Challies and others were giving. So just another tidbit.
And we'll have some quotes coming about what Dr. Little just said, because that's one of his main points. And we've got, yeah, direct quotes. So this is a quote. The publisher described the book in this way. After many years of writing her own words in her prayer journal, missionary Sarah Young decided to be more attentive to the Savior's voice and began listening to what he was saying. So with pen in hand, she embarked on a journey that forever changed her and many others around the world. Now that right there is from the current edition, Tim. So she is claiming to write down what Jesus tells her, but it is muted. You're correct. It's very overt in that first edition. If I get my hands on a copy of a first edition, that would be great. Listener, if you find a first edition and you could point, oh man, I would take that. So Challies says this, after he discusses it more, he says, there's no way to avoid her claim that she is communicating divine revelation. A claim that raises a host of questions and concerns, not the least of which is the doctrine of Scripture alone, and which assures us that the Bible and the Bible alone is sufficient guide in all matters of faith and practice. So even if they scrub what she said and they kind of make it just she's writing her thoughts down, she's still claiming to write down special revelation that's written down that you need to listen to. It's like the Venn diagram of inspiration, and it's overlapping 99.9999%. That's the problem. All right. Secondly, she proclaims the insufficiency of the Bible. Now this right here is enough. I mean, the other one, I would dump it, but this one right here, I would completely dump it. This is why I dump psychology. This is why I dump sociology. This is why I dump all kinds of worldly understandings of the world, of reality. She proclaims the insufficiency of the Bible. So she actually talks about reading the Bible and being dissatisfied with her Bible reading. And she says, I wonder if I could actually receive messages during my time of communing with God. And so she had been writing in prayer journals. And so she did this. She said, I had done all the talking. I knew that God communicated with me through the Bible, but I yearned for more. Increasingly, I wanted to hear what God had to say to me personally on a given day. So she's literally saying my Bible reading was not good enough for me. Challie says in those few sentences, she sets up an unnecessary competition between her revelation and what we are told of the Bible in 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, where it says, all scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. The man of God may be equipped, complete and equipped for every good work. And so she goes on to essentially say the Bible's not enough. Number three, her deepest experience of God comes through the practice that God does not endorse. She just points out that she gets meditative and she empties her mind and that she has these big desires, but her desires are not being fulfilled by the scriptures. They're being fulfilled by her own thoughts. She's untrustworthy. She's inspired by untrustworthy models. Okay, in an early version of Jesus calling it to him, I think this is probably close to what you're talking about. She described that way that she modeled her practice of listening. She described it as a devotional book written by two anonymous listeners. There was this other book called God Calling, and these two people would listen, and whatever God says, they would write down. These women practiced waiting quietly in God's presence with pencils and paper in hand, recorded the messages that they received from him. This little paper book became a treasure to me. It dovetailed remarkably well with my longing to live in Jesus's presence. And then Tim Challie says this, it's worth noting that recent versions of Jesus Calling have been scrubbed of this information. God Calling is an equally troubling book that saw much success beginning in the 1930s and has seen a revival of interest in the wake of Jesus Calling. It is at times sub-biblical and at other times patently unbiblical. And yet it is a book that she regards as a treasure and a model for her own work. So really there's some really big problems here with what's going on, and a lot of it has to do with the scriptures are not sufficient, and her own inner voice is her indicator of what God's telling her. She's got some other issues, but it also mimics occult practices, and so he walks through the way that the occult operates, where you empty your mind and just listen to your inner voice, and he says this is exactly what she's doing. Her emphasis doesn't mention the emphasis in the Bible. Here he just points out the first mention of Christ even dying for our sins doesn't appear until the February 28th. It's a daily devotional, by the way. I don't know if I said that. So you got to get all the way to February 28th before she mentions Christ dying for you. And then the next reference to Christ, which is wearing his robes, is not till August 9th. So how do you have a book about Jesus without really referencing it? All right, number eight is one of my favorites. He points out that her tone does not match the Bible's. Now, I'm going to read Challie's. I'm going to give you a direct quote. It can't be not denied. The Jesus of Sarah Young sounds suspiciously like a 21st century Western middle-aged woman. And I'm telling you, this is the same as the Jesus seminar or the quest for the historical Jesus in the 18th century. These guys are like, well, we think we know which verses in the Bible he said and which ones he didn't. And when people look at Jesus, it's like, well, that's like an 1800s enlightened man.
Which, by the way, the namesake of the Shack Stack is the book, The Shack, that depicts God as
woman.
A middle-aged woman.
A middle-aged woman, yep. Yeah. And
read his quote. When your joy in me meets my
joy in you. I'm about to read the quote, Tim.
Fireworks of heavenly ecstasy. Jesus doesn't talk like that. It's like great. It's beautiful.
What's beautiful about it, Tim? No, explain.
Well, that kind of language is just that
one. So listener, let me set this up a little better than just Tim did just a minute ago. He's like looking at this thinking like, oh my word, I can't handle this. So here's what Challie's does. I'm going to read three quotes from the book and I want you to listen to it. Now, Tim just read the first one. What Tim saw is in big letters, I have cringe quotes and then it's highlighted and it's just horribly bad. And so these are quotes from Jesus Calling. Now you listener asked, is this what Jesus sounds like in the Bible? Quote, when your joy in me meets my joy in you, there are fireworks of heavenly ecstasy. Now, I can't even comment on what kind of ecstasy I think she's thinking of. That's just totally awkward. Next quote. Wear my love like a cloak of light covering you from head to toe. That awkward. And then third one, bring me the sacrifice of your precious time. This time creates sacred space around you, space permeated with my presence and my peace. And so then Challies asked this question, why does Jesus suddenly speak in such different language? It's just so cringy. It's so cringy. Now, listener, it's cringy, but you're also saying this is what Jesus is saying. If you get that wrong, that's a huge problem. In Revelation, if you add to the book of Revelation, God threatens to add the plagues to your life. If you take away from the book of Revelation, he threatens to take away your name in his book of life. The point here is that God's inspired revelation is extremely serious because it's God's words, and God's words have God's authority. So if she's saying these are God's words and you take them as God's authority in your life, she is leading. She's like putting a millstone around your neck. This is a really bad situation. All right. She generates confusion. And then the 10th one I want to read, there's been huge corrections. So most people don't know that Jesus' calling has undergone revisions. Not only the introduction, Dr. Lee, you mentioned that earlier, where she removed references to the book God Calling, but also in the words she claimed to have received from Jesus. Listener, pause. If she got words from Jesus and then later she had to fix them, what does that say about her revelation?
I don't think she fixed them, but anyway.
Well, they were fixed by someone, yeah, which meant they were not correct anyway, to start with.
Yeah.
So he goes on to say, this, of course, casts doubt even further of the trustworthiness of the revelation that she receives. After all, why would words from Jesus need to be revised? Did God lie? Did he change? Did she mishear him? There is no good option here other than to doubt all that she's ever claimed to receive. And then he has an apologetics website that put two sections side by side and compared what they're saying. And it's just huge. It's not just like little changes. It's like changing the substance of these points. So all that to say, this book is seriously bad. It is not a good book. And it's one of those that if you rely on it, you are going to think this is what Jesus is saying. And there's no way he's saying that. Now, we're talking about the Presbyterians this week, and it's really like less of an ecclesiological odyssey, and it's more of a reason to talk about this book. But I do think we could make this comparison that's helpful. I'm not Presbyterian. I'm not sprinkling babies. I'm not thinking there's a covenant. Okay, all those things. But this Presbyterian group believes the Bible is true and it's God's inerrant, sufficient word. And when they have just someone claiming to say things about Jesus, and she's not saying gay people can be pastors, she's just saying these affirming, ooey-gooey nonsense things. Look at the way they responded. They're saying, this is such a serious issue. We've got to actually make a committee and make a statement about this because people think we believe this. Compare that with the United Methodists from a couple weeks ago, where we want to have gay pastors, so let's break the denomination up so we can do it over here and you can do what you want over here. It's like a tale of two denominations. So, listener, I would say, not trying to make you Presbyterian, I'm just trying to point out that denominations, you can tell them, we can tell what they're like the way they handle things like this. And then secondly, if you have been taken by Jesus' calling, you could feel embarrassed right now. You could feel frustrated. You could feel like we're attacking your favorite book. I would just say, read this article and then think about it for a moment. Like, is there something to this? And I do think there's something to this, and you should be concerned and maybe give it some thought.
Isaiah 8:17 states, I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. If you find some kind of shallowness in your Bible reading or your relationship with God, understand the response isn't to go and look for some other revelation that's going to deepen it. The response is to get into the Word and to be patient. Wait on him. So in Proverbs 12 and Proverbs 16, we have some instruction about the mouth. My children and I have been working through Proverbs and talking about one's speech. We've had a little bit of an issue with insulting one another in the little household. And so I thought this might be an appropriate devotional time for our family. So Proverbs 12, 16 through 18 is the first text that I want to look at here. I'm going to read out of the ESV. The vexation of a fool is known at once, but the prudent ignores an insult. Whoever speaks the truth gives honest advice, but a false witness utters deceit. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. So I told my children they had to memorize this passage because it talks about how to handle an insult. In Proverbs 12:16, the prudent ignores an insult. And what is our natural fleshly response when somebody insults us? We insult them back. And so what does the Proverbs teach us? Well, how should we respond when somebody insults us? They shame us. Well, you just kind of ignore them because the prudent understands where this is going. In Proverbs 12:18, the tongue of the wise brings healing. That's how it ends. The first line, though, is there is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts. What are we doing with our mouth? What are we saying? Are we like jabbing people? And that's a lot of times what those insults are. So Proverbs 12:16 through 18, it really speaks to the truth of what God gives wisdom concerning our mouths. The second text I wanted to highlight is Proverbs 16:21 through 23. The wise of heart is called discerning, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. And this gets into just a philosophy of education a little bit as well. How you communicate truth matters, and having a sweet mouth, a sweet tongue, increases the ability to persuade somebody. If you're speaking and you're being condescending, if you're being arrogant and being belittling, well, you're probably not going to persuade somebody of the right path. Proverbs 16:23, right after it, two verses after it, makes a similar statement. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. This idea of persuasiveness occurs in verse 21 and 23. I had my children memorize these Proverbs as well. Proverbs 16:21 through 23. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious. When we're speaking, how are we using our mouths? Is it in a righteous? Is it in a judicious way? There's a time to speak and there's a time to keep your mouth shut. Oh, I'm being insulted. Well, what's the response? Maybe you should just be quiet. It adds persuasiveness to his lips. Responding with words of kindness when somebody is speaking, is angry with you. It can diffuse a situation. Proverbs 16:21 through 23 are very helpful proverbs when it comes to how we should use our mouths appropriately. And so I would just encourage you, listener, as you think through how to speak, how to use your lips, how to use your mouth in a judicious and a wise way. When somebody insults you, well, maybe you just need to repay them with kindness, or maybe you just need to be silent. When you're communicating with somebody and they need a little character modification, how are you speaking? Is it in a persuasive way, or is it going to be in a way that they're going to chafe under it? And I would encourage you, be wise in your speech this week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.